This episode of The Orb is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 150,000 titles for your smartphone, tablet, or desktop. To get a free audiobook of your choice, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm.
This is J.G. Hertzler, General Mar Talker on Deep Space Nine, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Welcome, Niners, to another episode of The Orb, our dedicated Deep Space Nine show. I'm Christopher Jones, and joining me today, underneath a pile of letters and envelopes, is Matthew Rushing. Matthew, why do you have so much mail piled up on your desk?
Well, Chris, I kind of feel like, you know, that scene in Miracle on 34th Street where they start pouring the mail into the courtroom. Well, it's just, it's all of that mail, Chris, that we've been getting about the Orb from the different listeners, and it really has piled up. You know, I'm really thankful, though, that it doesn't come in letter form anymore, and I just had to go through some email to get it.
What if it came by owl, though? Now, I think that's something you would appreciate.
Yeah, as long as the owl didn't stop and, you know, decide that he needed to use the restroom somewhere in my house after he delivered the mail, yeah, it'd be great with that.
Yeah, you don't want that. They're trained not to do that, though.
Yeah, hopefully. Yeah.
Well, we're doing a different kind of Orb today, actually. The thing is that we get a lot of feedback on the Orb, and, you know, our discussions here on the show tend to get very serious and very deep. And we have wonderful listeners who enjoy those discussions and want to share their thoughts with us as well. Sometimes they have questions. Sometimes they have their own ideas on the subject that we're talking about, which we love to hear about. And we find that the format of the Orb is such that by the time we get to the end of the discussion, it's hard to really properly address feedback on the show. So we're going to start doing these shows, which are the Orb of Mail. These are supplemental episodes of the Orb, which are mailbag episodes. And we're just going to pick out some of the letters we've received and discuss those here on these episodes. So this is the first supplemental Orb, the Orb of Mail.
Chris, I always felt sorry for the Vedic that had found the Orb of Mail in that small Bajoran cave. I think he wished he wouldn't have uncovered it because he just spent the rest of his life transcribing old messages, that the prophets had sent back and forth. They weren't really prophecies, but they were kind of more like the prophetic text messages that they'd sent back and forth.
There are. I mean, it's surprising. It's, you know, there was the message that was sent warning about a danger to Valhalla. And then there's the other one that says, hey, did you get my message about, you know, and it's like 10,000 years old and he's just now finding it. So,
yeah. And it's kind of like a facepalm moment at that point.
Right. Like, yeah.
Guys, if you had sent us this orb a little bit earlier, again, maybe we would have been able to do something.
That's what we need, Matthew. We need a Vedic facepalm t-shirt.
Oh my gosh, that's awesome. That's what we should give something on the Orb these days. We need like a slapping sound or whatever to go with it, you know, like that it, like when a character has just a totally brain dead moment, it's a Vedic facepalm.
Oh, awesome. I love it. All right. Well, we have picked out four letters to talk about in depth here on the show today. And Matthew, the first one is from listener Brad Alexander about the Breen raid, which we talked about a while back. How did the Breen get to Earth? How did they attack Starfleet headquarters? And in his letter, Brad said, first, you did make an interesting point when you asked how the Breen made it all the way to Earth to attack. I had never considered this until you brought it up. I ruminated on it for a few minutes while driving into work this morning. The thought I came up with was Doolittle's raid, where they took bombers, flew them off of aircraft carriers, and pulled a one-time bombing raid on Tokyo. Now, whether they hid the Marine fighters inside a freighter or what, I don't know. So that's the first part of the letter. What do you think about that?
You know, I think it's an interesting idea. You know, it came as close as I could get in my mind to making it realistic. The idea that, you know, Doolittle had done this to Tokyo, you know, 30 Seconds Over Tokyo. It's a famous movie. It's a good book. It's a true story. It was a crazy, daring raid. The U.S. needed some kind of victory at that point, and they needed it to... They need it to be big. And so I feel like it does have a lot of correlations with what the Breen do to the Federation in a lot of ways. The Federation at that point is kind of in a stalemate with the Dominion. And then the Breen come in and they do this huge raid and it puts fear in everybody's hearts. So
it's kind of like a symbolic gesture, right? I mean, I don't think the Breen felt they were really going to take out Starfleet by attacking San Francisco. But like you said, it puts fear in the hearts of the humans because, hey, these guys can attack us here, which was really unprecedented. I mean, even, I think it's Martok, right? That says even my people never tried that. And at the same time, I mean, I would normally say maybe it also gives some motivation to the Dominion side, although I don't know if Jim Hadar really worked that way.
Yeah, exactly. But the Breen do and the Cardassians do. And I think that's definitely as well the Dominion was really hoping to get out of this situation. You know, the only thing about this is, it does kind of make sense, but Doolittle's raid is at a time where radar is not great. It's not half as precise as it even is now. And of course, you know, the idea of sneaking into the sole section of space, you know, in our solar system, in the Star Trek universe, is a little outlandish still to me. Just that idea, because
you can always use Jupiter and you can use the clouds and you can just kind of sneak and rise up out of it, Matthew. You know, if you warp in and you hit the brakes at just the right time, I mean, no one's going to see
that. That's right. I think he makes a fantastic point because it really does a great job of looking at that. And he goes along later in the letter just talking about how Ronald D. Moore was not above kind of using history as the template for his stories and how he had done that in Battlestar Galactica, kind of using the Battle of Midway as a reminder there. And so I definitely can see, you know, Ronald Moore knowing history well enough to kind of give the Breen this one-shot move. And like I think we talked about it, it really does. It sets fear in the hearts of people of the Federation. And it plays into when even Bashir and O'Brien have that conversation about Starfleet Medical and why they won't let them have the records for Odo. And O'Brien says, well, you know, guys like him, Hilliard, they're very used to just kind of sitting behind the desk and not having any, you know, action happen at all.
Yeah.
And having Starfleet attacked really could have rattled him in a way that we hadn't seen coming. So
I think
some great points Brad makes here. I really appreciate his writing in because it made me rethink the issue too.
Yeah, definitely. And about Ronald D. Moore, Battlestar Galactica, it actually ties back to the Doolittle's raid bit because he said that in the Battlestar Galactica episode Resurrection Ship, Apollo had to eject from his fighter and was floating in space as the battle unfolded around him. I thought that reminded me of the Battle of Midway from World War II with Ensign George Gay, who was the sole survivor from his torpedo squadron. Moore later confirmed that this was his inspiration in the podcast companion to that episode of Battlestar Galactica. So I suspect that Doolittle's raid was the inspiration for the raid on Starfleet. So actually, I would say this is beyond just speculation on Brad's part, but actually seems very likely that this is what Moore was thinking about.
Which is great. I mean, this is one of the best parts of having the feedback from the listeners is them having, you know, obviously the internet as a resource that and having put their thought into it as well. And I think
I do know a bit from Brad that he does have a military background. And so I think this is stuff that, of course, the internet being a resource is great, but probably popped into his head pretty quickly thinking about what, you know, the action the Breen took.
And I'm kind of surprised that I never even thought about it, because I'm a huge World War II geek. You know, I really enjoy, I loved reading about that stuff when I was a kid. I still enjoy reading a good, you know, history of something in World War II every once in a while. So I definitely see this as well. Mm. The moment he mentioned Doolittle, I was like, I wanted to do,
Did you do a Vedic facepalm?
Myself, because that I hadn't thought of it. But it really does make perfect sense.
Great. Well, you mentioned the records with Starfleet Medical as well. And another letter that Brad sent us was about the virus, where we talked about, you know, Section 31 and who created the virus. And he said, with respect to Starfleet Medical and the morphogenic virus, how far in advance did Section 31 or whoever create the virus? Bashir beat on this virus for who knows how long in Showtime, months at least, and the only way he found out about it was to go inside of Sloane's head. So the initial creation had to occur sometime before Homefront Paradise Lost back in Season 4. Now, I haven't calculated by the star dates, but is it possible that they had the virus waiting or partially created just in case Odo's people, wherever they were, turned out to be hostile? Do they have something similar for other races waiting in the wings? Something to bring down the Klingons, the Romulans, the Breen? This is really interesting, Matthew, and I actually had a similar conversation with someone else. I can't remember who it was now, and I think we were talking on Twitter or maybe Facebook, but similar, like, how far ahead did Starfleet create this, and did they do it, like, in Season 2 when we first start to hear about the Dominion being out there, but they're not really a threat yet? Did someone in Starfleet or Section 31 think, you know, these guys could be a problem, maybe we should start working on something? And the idea that they might have viruses, I mean, biological weapons tailored to races like the Klingons and the Romulans or the Breen, especially Klingons and Romulans, who they really know well. That's kind of chilling, isn't it? That someone within the Federation or Starfleet would even be doing that?
Well, it was interesting the way he worded this, because it apparently Section 31 is Batman. Because Batman actually has this same exact thing for every single member of the Justice League. So, I mean, and that's one of the things that makes Batman and Superman, in the end, such great friends, is because Superman is the only one who trusts Batman with a piece of kryptonite to take him out if he goes crazy.
Yeah.
And Batman also creates a contingency plan for all the other superheroes just in case something goes wrong with them. So
what does he do for the Wonder Twins, for example? Like, how is he going to take them out?
I think he just separates them eternally so they can't smack their hands together and turn into whatever.
Is Gleekly like an agent who's working with Batman, who's there, and you can trigger him if you say the right word?
Probably. Okay. And I mean, who knows what he does to Shazam? I mean, he's just not allowed people to say that word around him. Who knows? So I just thought that was a really interesting idea. The thing that maybe Section 31 has these contingency plans for other races, which is something that I've never thought of before.
I've never thought of it either. It does make sense, though, but it's frightening.
Yeah, it is. And so, you know, kind of the idea of how long they have been thinking about this, my guess is from the moment that Starfleet met Odo,
right?
They were thinking, where does this guy come from and who is he? And the moment that they knew that he was from a place called the Dominion in another part of the galaxy, I think the name alone scared them kind of crapless.
Right.
And they're okay, we need a contingency plan for these guys. And then they had the perfect ability to do it. You know, they had had Bashir's medical records, you know, of scanning Odo when he first came on the station, and had everything they needed. And, you know, we know that Section 31 has some serious top minds thinking about things. So just because Bashir beat his head against the virus for so long doesn't mean that, you know, I couldn't put it past Section 31 getting this by some sort of nefarious means if they had
to. Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, I would think the moment that they, like you said, the moment they met Odo, just the idea of a shapeshifter would have to be very frightening to them. And then knowing that there must be more of them out there somewhere, even before hearing of the Dominion, it is possible that they started working on a contingency plan. What if more of these shapeshifters come around, and what if they're not friendly?
Yeah, exactly. In the same way, I think that they probably have thought about the Klingons or the Romulans or the Breen. It makes me wonder, too, you know, we talk so much in Deep Space Nine about how nobody's seen a Breen and lived to tell about it and all those kind of things, except for Kira and Dekat when they take over right. those Breen's costumes, and they definitely see them then.
Well, no, not in my headcanon. You know, my headcanon is that those Breen were in the shower and Kira and Dukat stole the suits while the Breen were in the shower, so they didn't actually see them.
They're in the shower and you don't just peek around the corner just to see what they look like?
Well, but, you know, it's that frosted glass type thing.
Oh,
you
can't, you have to open the door. Frosted window panes.
Yes, exactly.
I cannot see you in the shower again.
Yes, that was, we never saw Vic sing that on the show, but it was a popular request. And it was based on that experience. Kira came back and told Vic all about it.
It's a great reworking of that song by Vic. So, but yeah, it is something interesting to think about. And the thoughts of just how crazy Section 31 is, man, I'm hoping we'll get something kind of like this in when David Mack has his new book come out called Disavowed, starring our one and only Bashir, and taking on Section 31. So for those of you who enjoy the novels, there's a little plug for David Mack's new book coming out this fall. And listen to Literary Treks as well. We talk a lot about Deep Space Nine there. So,
well, Abyss. We've done Abyss, part of the relaunch series, and that deals with Section 31 and Bashir
as well. It does. So. It does very much so. So,
The last thing I'll say on this is that the Klingons, this is the one that I find really troubling if this were really going on, because the Klingons and the Federation at this point in history are allies. They're uneasy allies, but you've got Worf in Starfleet. There is general cooperation through TNG and DS9 between the Klingons and the Federation. I mean, sometimes, you know, your crazy Uncle Gowron gets a bee in his bonnet, which is a really popular saying on Kronos, and, you know, tries to stir things up. But it's the idea that you would have this ally and yet you would still maybe have some kind of virus on hand that could wipe them out. It's just not something that you would expect from the Federation and, you know, the Roddenberry's ideals of what we would be in the future.
Definitely. Definitely. And it's a scary thought as well. I mean, and so.
Well, the next letter we have, this one's right up your alley, Matthew. This is from Ed Summers, and it's all about Ezri, talking about the episode we did a while back related to the Trill. And his question is, do you think it would have been better for the show if we had gotten to know Ezri Teagan a little before she became Ezri Dax? So there are a couple of pieces here. That's the first one. What do you think about that?
Well, the idea of getting to know Ezri Teagan, I think, would have been a little bit interesting. You know, maybe if they had known a little bit before that they did, obviously, that Terry was going to be leaving, they could have found somebody to replace her and kind of introduce this new Trill character. Although I think that just would have really played their hand at that point.
Yeah.
I think this is the hard part. It would have been cool, but I think that knowing that this character was going to live on automatically because they had already introduced a Trill character and we would have all just figured it out.
Yeah.
You know, having her show up at, you know, Sisko's in Louisiana and say, hello, Benjamin, it's me, you know, and it's just a completely different character, which is kind of a, you know, big old mind blowing thing, especially since this is way before the internet was what it is now. So,
Well, Ed says, I know the writers did not have time to plan for Terry's exit, but what if they had known a year in advance? So that's kind of what you're talking about here. They could have introduced Ezri Teagan at the beginning of season 6 as a recurring character, like O'Brien on TNG. Although with O'Brien, he's there from the very, very first episode. He's there on the battle bridge in Encounter at Farpoint. So he was really maybe not introduced. He was just there, but he was a recurring character. Anyway, Ed says, then at the end of season six, left us with Bashir attempting an emergency joining of Dax to Ezri after Jadzia's death. It would have been a great cliffhanger, and we would have had an investment in the Ezri character at that point. Here's my take on it, though, Matthew, is we've been talking during our final chapter discussion a lot about how important Ezri is to the resolution of the story, especially with the Klingon Empire and with Worf. And I actually think that if Ezri had been on the station as a Trill, but not joined, she's just there, for all of Season 6, I don't think Season 7 works, because Worf would have gotten to know her as Ezri Teagan. And I think that changes the nature of her being Dax afterwards, because part of what makes it possible for me for Ezri to say the things that she does to Worf and for it to have the impact, because Worf is struggling with this new young girl who's telling him these things, is the fact that he really doesn't know her. That she has the memories of his wife, his dead wife, but he does not know who this Ezri girl is, and he's having to listen to it.
Yeah, I think that, as well as he's had a very short time to have somebody prove that she's worthy of being listened to.
Right.
I think that's the other thing, when they have that, I specifically think of that conversation where they're talking about the Klingon Empire, and she just says point blank, I think it's time for the Klingon Empire to die. You know, they've just had the conversation that he and Martok, Worf and Martok, both feel that she is worthy, not only of, in their estimation, of being a Dax, they feel, but also being part of the House of Martok, which is a huge deal for Klingons. And so I like, though, that they've only had that one season to figure that out. I think it actually is a benefit that we don't see Ezri. And I have to say this, Ezri does get a lot of play in the last season, and that could be annoying to some people. But one, I think she's pivotal to the season, and obviously for continuing in the books, for all of those who enjoy that have enjoyed that in the relaunch. But it did that thing where it really brought some life into the show, you know, having this new character to get to know and wrapping everything up. And I felt like they just did it really well, so that by the time she's saying those things, you as an audience member, you know Ezri, I think, as well as you need to, how different she is from Jandzia, and exactly what she means to Worf, and that she's earned her right to be able to say this. And I think if we had known her beforehand, it would, you're right, you know, she changes a lot because she has the Dax symbiont. So it wouldn't really have necessarily helped.
I think there are two levels to it. I think that when we started doing the orb, you know, I'm not a big fan of Ezri. And then I knew that you were a big fan of Ezri. And it has taken me a long time. I mean, what we've done, how many shows? 67, 68 shows on here. It's taken me a long time to come around to seeing the value of Ezri on the show, because I think the two levels are the fan perception of the change from Jadzia to Ezri and how it actually happened on the screen, and then her role within the storytelling. And I think that you, to appreciate how she fits in, and why maybe it is a good thing that we didn't get to know her ahead of time, as we're talking about here, you have to kind of go over the seventh season many times and really dig into it the way that we've been doing. And then you can start to see why there is value in the way it was done, even though it wasn't planned, because as Ed points out here, they didn't have time to plan for Terry Farrell's exit from the show. She was just kind of written off. I think that for the average fan watching Deep Space Nine and encountering the death of Jadzia and the introduction of Ezri, I think that what Ed describes, we could have gotten to know her as a recurring character over the course of season six, would make that transition easier for everybody. And on the most basic level, it would probably help the Dax character to be accepted. It would help Ezri be accepted. And it would give more of a feeling of continuity to the show. But I ultimately think that it would have weakened the strength of the storytelling in the final chapter.
Yeah, definitely.
All right. So thanks for that, Ed. And then the last thing we're going to talk about today, Matthew, is a letter from Nathaniel Robinson on the Prophets. And he said, your last podcast touched on all sorts of issues related to the 9-episode arc. I look forward to hearing all of the podcasts. Among the issues that you touched upon was the final realization of the emissary's narrative. One of you mentioned that it could conceivably be a problem that the Prophets knew the outcome of Sisko's final confrontation with Dukat, undermining the drama because Sisko's life was never truly in jeopardy. I think I may have been the one who said that, Matthew. I don't remember anymore, but I kind of remember that conversation. I'm not sure that you explored the non-linearity of the Prophets in the previous podcasts, but it wasn't necessarily explored in great detail by the series. I am not myself convinced that being outside linear time is the same thing as being timeless or eternal. The Prophets don't meet the Neoplatonic criteria for supreme beings. They are powerful, but not all-powerful. They are knowledgeable, but not all-knowing. And they seem mostly confined to the Bajoran system. Indeed, they need Sisko to tell them things. The different temporal natures of corporeal beings, the pilot, or the realities of politics, sacrifice of angels. And there are things that they seem powerless to prevent or undo without outside help, as in Tears of the Prophets. I think that being outside linear time does not give them complete knowledge of time, particularly of the future. They may see time in the same way we see a landscape. Distant events might be visible, but the details could be fuzzy until they get closer. Perhaps they needed Sisko to experience events in order to bring the future into greater focus. The Locust prophecy seems too important to have waited until the last minute. On the other hand, the clearest prophecy concerning the attempt to establish communications with the Gamma Quadrant occurred on their doorstep. It's possible that the Prophets could not have known the relevant details of the confrontation in the fire caves until Sisko was there, and that may have been Sisko's most enduring role as the emissary, bridging the gaps between their non-linear existence and the corporeal world. Okay, so very lengthy, but I think very interesting letter here from Nathaniel. What are your thoughts on this, Matthew?
Well, I've been thinking about this one for a while, Chris, and my thought process was this. I'm kind of beginning to think of the Prophets as a mirror for the way that the Founders work. The Founders don't enjoy solids. They don't enjoy dealing with them. They tend to spend most of their time pulled on their own little island, their mm-hmm. own little planet, and they deal with solids as little as possible. And I'm beginning to think of the Prophets in that way as well, is that, you know, if you are something that is outside of time, which this begins to get a little bit mind-boggling when you start to think something being outside of time in the first place, I have the feeling that their idea of not knowing something or not being knowledgeable about something has to do with that they've kind of removed themselves from it, but that doesn't mean they can't know it or do know it. It's just that they've stopped being intimately involved with it. And it's the same way they are a deist version of what Christians think of as God. Most Christians believe God to be immanent, that he is here. Like mm-hmm. he is outside of time, but he is also intimately involved in everything that's going on inside.
Here somehow.
Yeah, exactly.
But not in the same way we are.
Exactly. And so whereas, you know, the Prophets seem to be much more like the kind of the deist version of God, where they've kind of wound everything up and then they just let it flow and they are basically off doing whatever it is that they do in their own little realm. And so that's really how I think of them. So I do think that they are supreme beings. I think they are all powerful. They show they can do anything. They have to be coerced a lot, like, you know, I say coerced in quotations, in kind of the same way we see things biblically, like Abraham asking God not to destroy Sodom and Gomorrah, and he bargains with God, and he bargains down, well, if there are, you know, he goes from like, well, if there are 20 good people, if there are 15 good people, if there are 10, you know, so I kind of see it kind of working that way. An Old Testament kind of version of God with gods who are very much in some ways seem removed, even though they're not, because they've obviously been laying these plans out for a long time. But for them, being outside of time, yeah, of course they kind of forget what it means to be corporeal, because mm-hmm. they're not intimately involved with corporeal natures for so long. You know, for them, they have to kind of reach back into time and get back involved in the swing of things, so to say. So I don't really see that being a huge issue. Part of this is he's right. We don't really get explained any of this. We feel like right. We know more about the prophets than we do. We just, yeah. And I think that's, again, the genius of Deep Space Nine and the writing there. And so
you feel like there's a lot more there than there really exactly. is in the show. Yeah. You know, it's really hard to wrap your mind around this. One thing that's interesting that Nathaniel said here is they may see time in the same way we see a landscape. Distant events might be visible, but the details could be fuzzy until they get closer. But before that, he says that being outside linear time, he thinks being outside linear time does not give them complete knowledge of time, particularly of the future. So I overall agree with this, I think, except for the part about particularly of the future, because time is fascinating to me in the first place. And I have a feeling that if we could really know the nature of existence, that time does not exist in the way that we think it does. You know, there's this idea that everything that's ever going to happen has already happened. It's just all out there. But our brains cause us to experience time flowing in one direction. So for us, that's how we see things, and we really can't see them in another way, or it's hard to imagine them in another way. But in reality, it is possible that everything is just laying out there. And so I love the description here of a landscape where things are scattered around. And so there may be events that are distant and we can't see the details of them. But that doesn't mean that they're any different than something that's closer to us. It's just if you picture them scattered around everywhere, well, they're far away and we don't see the details. However, since there's no time, like all these things have happened, there is no future. So I don't think there would be a distinction between particularly of the future versus particularly of the past, because again, that's us putting a label on it. I think that it's possible that there are some events that they know more about than others just because they have not had close contact with those events on the landscape yet. So maybe they don't know the details of it.
Well, yeah. And it seems, again, this is kind of where that deist idea is. And if you think of time as just a line, that they've kind of inserted themselves into certain points of it where they kind yeah. of know more than
other
points.
You can't think of it as a line, though. If you're thinking that there is no past, present, or future, it can't really be a line. That's why I think this description of a landscape where things are scattered
yeah,
around
but
is
my,
really good.
Yeah, but my point in saying that I'm thinking of it from a human standpoint, yeah. that we are in a line.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So if they are outside of that, they can go into any point in the line at any time.
Right.
So mm-hmm. there is no past, present, or future them. It's all the same.
Right.
And
we see that with their interactions with Cisco.
Exactly.
We see them like just jumping to different points. So there is no travel involved, right? They're just, they can just be there at any point.
Right.
Yeah.
And in the same way that, they're able to go from point to point to point in Cisco's life and it doesn't really matter. They can just be there. So yeah, I think this is just a really interesting conversation. But in the end, I tend to think of the prophets as basically a more deist form of supreme being that happens to be just slightly more interested of how things turn out. And for some reason, and again, we're never told this, is what is it that makes them of Bajor? Which I think yeah. if I could ask any question of, like, say, Ronald D. Moore or especially Ira Stephen Baer, what is it about the prophets that makes them of Bajor?
Yeah. And see, I picture them more as And I don't know if this is what I said on a past show, because my thoughts are evolving all the time, but especially after reading Nathaniel's message here and then talking to you about it, I see them more as a very advanced alien race like the Q, who live outside of time as we know it, but they're not necessarily all powerful. They are not necessarily aware of every event that's ever happened. They have limitations, but they seem to be godlike to us. And they generally don't interact with our realm of existence. But for some reason, which we don't know, like you just said, they feel responsible for the Bajorans in the way that the caretaker felt responsible for the Ocampa on Voyager. But maybe not for the same reason, but just in the kind of the relationship. And for some reason, they feel responsible for the Bajorans, but they don't have, and this is, I guess, where you talked about Christianity and God and how people view that. I would say that people probably tend to think that God had more involvement in the affairs of life on Earth at some point in the past than he does today. Just in a tangible way, like people say, show me a sign, right? Like we read about these things in the Bible that happened a long time ago, but we don't necessarily see those types of things happening today. And the point here is that it feels like at some point 10,000 years ago or more, the prophets had more involvement with the Bajorans than they do now. And now they're just kind of there. And occasionally there's some kind of mystical interaction, but otherwise not. And they're just off doing their thing, whatever it is that they do, like you described earlier with this view of God winding everything up and then letting it run, and then they're off doing their thing. So I've kind of come to see them in that way a little bit. But ultimately, yeah, they're like some advanced alien race that lives in this other realm.
And in either way, I mean, they have more power over space and time than I've even seen necessarily, I guess, the Q. I mean, creating a stable wormhole, they're the only people being able to do that.
Yeah.
They have powers at least comparable to a Q, if not greater. Yeah. And I think that's one of the things that made them so mysterious, is that we really didn't see them do these kind of things. You know, we saw Q bouncing around and, you know, whatever he wanted to do, he could do. It also seems like the prophets have a lot more benevolence to them in a strange way. I mean, they seem kind of remote a lot of the times, but there's a lot more benevolence to them and care to them. So they have much more of a...
Well, the Q seem to be people like us who have evolved to the point that they have the powers they have. And so they get bored just like we do with things. And that's why we see Q, John Delancey's Q, doing the things that he does. It just like
screw around. Yeah, and it seems like the prophets have a completely different view of what it means to exist. And we've never explored really that existence whatsoever in Star Trek. And so it still is really just a great mystery.
Yeah. So, Nathaniel, thank you for your letter. That was a very interesting one. And that's all that we're going to cover today for letters. But everyone, please keep sending us your feedback. We're going to start doing these supplemental Orb of Mail shows from time to time so that we can actually give attention to the feedback the way that we have today. So we'd love to hear from you, your thoughts on each of our shows. There are a number of ways you can do that. Trek.fm/contact. That's one way. Use the form there. Choose to send to a show and choose the orb, and that will come to both Matthew and me by email. You can also talk to us on Facebook and Twitter. Our username is TrekFM on both of those. And I'm C. Brian Jones, the letter C and Brian with a Y, everywhere. And Matthew, how can people reach you on Twitter and Facebook?
Yeah, you can get me on Twitter at MattRushing02. Then, of course, what we talked about a little bit here, Chris, we also do Literary Treks together, and so you can find me there. And hit me up with the feedback forms here for the Orb or Literary Treks. We really appreciate the feedback. It's great. It's a lot of fun to be able to interact like this, and so I'm really excited that we'll be doing this more often. I think we're going to have some great conversations this way with the listeners here. And so Yeah, keep them coming and hit us up on Twitter. Ask those questions, because I enjoy during the day having a little break in the monotony with a great Star Trek conversation.
Right. And we also have forums at trek.fm/forums if you want to go there and start a conversation. Our newer forum system has a feature where you can tweet out your post that you've posted something. I really encourage everyone to do that, to let the wider world know that the post is there, because it is hard to drum up interaction on forums these days because there are just so many different outlets for that. And also, you can send us a voicemail. We'd love to hear your voice if you want to record a message and send that to us. There is a widget in the left sidebar on the show pages for the Orb. You'll see it. It says send us a voicemail. Or you can go to speakpipe.com/trekfm. And all you need there is your webcam's microphone, or if you have a smartphone or a tablet, you can use the mic on there. And you can record the message and you can upload it to us right there from the site or from that page. And we'd love to hear from you that way. Well, this isn't the only thing we've been talking about here on the network this past week, so here's a quick taste of some other things you can hear elsewhere on Trek FM.
Previously on Trek.fm, Standard Orbit.
I'm just going to say this up front. I don't know if it's Koenig or Koenig. I've heard both. I'm going to go with Koenig, but if I'm wrong, just pretend I said Koenig the whole time.
And I'll go with Koenig.
All right.
And then,
so our bases
and
are
then,
covered.
So we'll both, okay. Yes, all one right. of us will be right.
Earl Grey.
They're like, we're supposed to be decommissioned. And Kirk's like, second star to the right. And then, like, what happens after that moment? They're like, they just start like...
Five minutes later, it's like, well...
I guess we have to turn around.
To the journey! To the journey is community. And that's what you find with Star Trek. And that's why we do what we do. And that's why we love it when you guys write us, find us on Twitter. And that's why we're all friends on Trek.fm, is because... we have this sense of community, and that's what it brings. It's not just about a show, it's about each other. Warp 5.
Mm-hmm. Archer's way is the right way. He brings the light. She walks into the light to talk to Archer, because then she is enlightened, because he is an enlightened man. She walks back into the darkness and retreats back into her world to pick up the slates and go teach the kids about the humans and the Skagarians and all that kind of stuff.
Commentary, Trek Stars.
I think it would be fun, in order to prove my point, would be like to us have us play a game of Monopoly, and also two players entirely determined by randomness. Two fictional players. It would be Mike, Max, Blue, and Green.
Continuing mission.
When we made the audio drama, it was a fairly straightforward transition. Let's call the ship the Excelsior. Let's make it the fourth one to bear the name. Let's put it in the Delta Quadrant. But now that we're there, I'm really happy with a lot of those things.
Melodic Treks.
Second Marriage took place in August 6, 1963, to Camille J. Williams, a Las Vegas dancer, and they had two children. And yes, I know, he divorced and married in the same year. I ain't gonna go anywhere near that. You draw your own conclusions.
Literary Treks.
I think I posited the idea that Lal was kidnapped, and Margaret just said in her Margaret E. way, she just said, Moriarty.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
So check out all of these shows and find out what we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe. You'll find us everywhere you get your podcasts. And if you're in iTunes or on Stitcher, be sure to review The Orb and review the other shows that you listen to on the network. You can also review the master feed if you've already reviewed The Orb or other shows in the past. And every review that you leave will get you a drawing in our contest for some great Star Trek prizes. We're giving away a season of Star Trek on Blu-ray or DVD. We're giving away some Star Trek novels. Also, some official Starship Collection ships from Japan with the Japanese magazine, a complete set of our alien art badges, and Alec Peters has donated some beautiful embroidered patches from Star Trek Axanar. If you listen to the Axanar show, the official podcast of Star Trek Axanar, which I co-host with Alec Peters, and review that, you can be in the running for those patches. It's very easy to enter. You just go and review the shows and then go to trek.fm/review and submit the form that you find there, and that will get your name in the running. And again, every review you leave will get you an entry. And the deadline for this is Sunday, August 17th at midnight Pacific time. So be sure to send us your reviews. Matthew, since we're doing a feedback show today, I did want to close out here by reading some reviews that we've gotten and share those with you. There's one from WLDKT1, which I don't know how to pronounce. Other Woodkit1. How's that, Matthew?
I love it. It sounds great.
But it says, favorite Trek podcast, 5 stars. This show is so much fun. Great hosts and great discussion of the best Trek series. I especially enjoy it when Sirach Lofton doesn't appear.
You know, Chris, I don't think he appeared in this episode.
He did not appear. He was not in this episode. Very true. There's one from 17 Brian. That's Brian with a Y. He says, Kapla! While all the Star Trek shows have good storylines, DS9 had some of the most complex story arcs of the 5 series. Chris and Matt do a good job of talking about the characters and events of DS9. There's one from Phasers to Wellesby, who says, covers all aspects of this epic series. This is another 5-star review, as was the one from 17 Brian. And Phasers to Wellesby says, DS9 is one of my favorites, and this podcast does it justice. The hosts take the time to look at the big arcs and themes of the series, but also get into the details that truly made this show great. Matthew, this one sounds like it might be for you. It's from Section 47, 5 stars, Bajoran Spring Wine. I love DS9, so I listen to the Orb. Got it?
I love it. That's short awesome.
I think he wants some of your spring wine that you're working on your business.
Yeah, you know, it's hard for me to get that out. It's a little bit like Bluebell. I drink all I can and I sell the rest, and usually I just don't have any to sell.
Here's another one from Sooner Thought. Thoughtful talk about Top Trek show. Star Trek Deep Space Nine is clearly, at least to me, the best of the Trek series. The Orb treats the show with the respect it is due. I appreciate the thoughtful discussions and news that may help others revisit this overlooked show. Great job. Matthew, do you feel like DS9 is still the overlooked show, or do you feel like people are really starting to embrace it more?
You know, I think that people are starting to embrace it more. But I also think, Chris, that there is just this aspect of people aren't sure what to do with it. I was talking to Jose Munoz on Twitter today, and we were just talking back and forth about the DC and Marvel Universe and those kind of things, and kind of comparing the two. And, you know, I came up with the comparison to him. I said, I feel like the Marvel Universe is TNG, and DC Universe right now, and the films especially, is DS9. And I know which one that I appreciate still more for its story elements and all of that kind of stuff. And he thought that that was a good comparison. And to me, I think the more people see Deep Space Nine, I think the more they see the relevance of it. And I think we talk about that a lot, Chris, here on the show, that Deep Space Nine, because of its kind of mythological framework, which I think throws a lot of people off again in the idea of Star Trek, really sets it apart and does allow you to be able to appreciate it more because of what it's saying now, and even now, as even compared to when it was on.
Yeah.
And I think more people are finding that. I just, you know, that's what we're here for, is to keep getting that message out that this is a show that's meant to be watched.
I think there are a lot of people who didn't watch DS9 in first run because they were turned off by it early on or something, and because there's been no new Star Trek for so long now, and there's Netflix, people are going and watching it finally. They're like, well, yeah, there's no new Star Trek, so I've not seen this one. I'm going to watch this. And then they're finding that, hey, this is actually really good.
Yeah, I agree with you. The same way I think that it's happened for Enterprise as well, for people to find that show and give it its due.
Well, there are 2 more reviews that I want to read here before we close this out. One from Chappie5574. If you're a Star Trek DS9 fan, or shall I say, if you're a Niner, you will love this podcast. Matthew Rushing is the best contributor to the network. He brings a great perspective to DS9 that others do not. Chris and Matt contrast each other very well and make for wonderful discussions into all things DS9. So I'm going to echo the sentiment here, Matthew of Chappie5574, and say I also agree. I mean, all of our contributors are wonderful on the network, but I really appreciate the perspectives that you have brought to DS9 and doing this show with you, because you do go far beyond what I see from almost anyone else when they talk about DS9.
Well, I really do appreciate that. That is wonderful feedback. Although, I mean, top contributor, Chris, I think you're on every single one of our shows at least once. somehow. So, you know, I can only hope to live up to you. So if I'm doing so well, it's only because I've learned from the best.
Oh, well, thank you. So thank you for that, Chappie. That's a wonderful review. And lastly today, one from, I'm going to say Parsec. It's P-A-R-5-E-C. I love this review. It's 5 stars and the subject line is boss plus awesome equals bossum.
Oh, that's great.
In this one person's opinion, DS9 was the Star Trek series that took the most risks and was the most rewarding to watch. If you agree, you'll love this podcast. If you disagree, you'll love shouting at this podcast as you listen to it in your car. I have done both. Now I am currently trawling through the back catalog, so ticked off I didn't find it sooner, so I could weigh in on the forums and comments on all the stuff they talked about earlier. I'm not missing a single one now. This podcast is truly worthy of being called both boss and awesome, and is, ergo, bossum.
I love it. That's a great review. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks for that. And if you're making your way, and this goes for everyone, if you're making your way through the back catalog, you know, if you get to episode 16 and there's something you want to say to us, let us know. I mean, it's been a long time. We probably won't remember off the top of our heads what we talked about on that show, but as we are doing these supplemental Orb of Mail shows, we would be happy to revisit those topics on these supplementals. So don't be afraid to talk to us about old shows. We do want to hear from you on those as well. All right, Matthew. Well, we've told everyone where to find us already. So let's close out by reminding everyone about our sponsor for today's show, audible.com. You can get a free audiobook of your choice if you go to audibletrial.com/trekafilm. And we really encourage you to do that because it really helps us keep the Orb coming to you every single week. So go over there. If you decide not to stick with Audible at the end of the trial, there's nothing to lose. You'll get to keep the free audiobook. But you can go pick one of the great Star Trek books that they have or any of the other books they have absolutely free and try it out. You're going to love it. I've been an Audible customer for 14 years. I couldn't live without Audible. And I promise you'll love it. So go check it out. audibletrial.com/trekfm. And we really thank Audible for their support of the show and the network.
Well, thanks everyone for listening to the supplemental. We really appreciate it, and we'll see you next time as we gaze into the Orb.